Well, we're not going to do the show that we had planned for this hour, the conversation with Donald Norman from Northwestern about his book Emotional Design, Why We Love or Hate Everyday Things. We have rescheduled that program, and we are going to do that on another day. Instead, we're turning to the Focus 580 archive, and we thought it might be relevant, and particularly in keeping with the last hour, to talk about another international topic, another area of concern, and that is North Korea. We are going back to a program that we first presented on December 5th, a conversation with two academics that are both Korea experts, but who take very different views on Korea and how the United States should be dealing with Korea, Victor Cha and David Kang, the names of the two guests. So that's what we'll be doing here in this hour of the show. As you listen, do keep in mind that we'll not be taking calls. And again, this program first broadcast on December 5th. This morning, we will review the continuing conflict between the United States and North Korea. The U.S., for some time now, has been arguing that North Korea's nuclear ambitions pose a threat, both to its neighbors and to the United States. The Pyongyang government, for its part, says that it feels threatened by the United States and wants both normal relations and economic assistance. This morning, in this part of the show, we will be talking with two guests who approach the subject of engagement with North Korea in different ways. Our guests are Victor Cha from Georgetown University. He is the Sung Korea Foundation Chair in Asian Studies and Professor of Government in the Edmund A. Walsh School of Government at Georgetown. Our other guest is David Kang. He's Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, and he's also Adjunct Associate Professor at the Tuck School of Business there at Dartmouth. Together, they have authored a book laying out their different points of view on the subject. The book is titled Nuclear North Korea, A Debate on Engagement Strategies, and it's published by the Columbia University Press. It is in bookstores if you'd like to read up on the subject. And of course, as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. We do ask callers to be brief so that we can get in as many as possible and keep the program moving. Anyone, however, who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana if you're listening over the air, or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States. You may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Cha, good morning.
Good morning.
And Professor Kang, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks very much to both of you for being with us.
My pleasure.
I think that maybe the place we might start is this. I think that particularly for people here in the United States, they have a difficult time thinking about how we should approach North Korea because of the difficulty of understanding what it is that motivates the government of North Korea. And often I think the when we're in a situation like that, the fallback position is to simply dismiss the leadership and say, well, they're not rational, so there's no way we can really understand what it is they're trying to do or what where they're coming from. And maybe both of you, and I guess we can go in alphabetical order at least to start. Maybe we'll start with Professor Cha. Maybe both of you can talk a little bit about, to the extent that we do understand it, what it is that the government of North Korea wants.
Well, thanks, David. I mean, the first thing that I would say is, in response to your question, is that's exactly why we wrote the book. This tends to be an issue that gets sort of less play in the face of Iraq and Afghanistan, yet the stakes are very high here. We're talking about potential nuclear weapons, proliferation of missiles, you know, possibly war. And there's very little that's known about the country for two reasons. One, because the regime itself is so opaque. And two, because the level of interest generally tends to be much lower with regard to this issue than it does with regard to Iraq or the events in Afghanistan. So this is why we wrote this book. I'll just give my first cut at your question, which is in terms of the regime's intentions. I've always been concerned that North Korea, in its current drive for nuclear weapons, really seeks to become a nuclear weapon state, that is not simply seeking to give up these weapons for help from the outside world, but it really wants to become a nuclear weapon state.
And Professor Kanger, you sounds as if now you could take the other point of view that says that perhaps what the North Koreans are using the nuclear weapons for as a chip, as a bargaining chip, and that their concern is they would like to be brought into the world community, have normal relations with the West. And certainly one thing we do know is that they do desperately need help from outside.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't even say that they're using it as a chip, which implies more of a calculated gamble. We'll start this program up just in order to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
What I think North Korea wants is a diplomatic solution to the 50-year war that we have had with North Korea and a resolution to that kind of a conflict. To me, the key question is whether North Korea has genuine security concerns or not. If they don't, then they are trying to just blackmail or extort. If they do have security concerns, then unless we address those, they're not going to disarm. And it would be very surprising if they did.
Mm.
And so I think they're willing to trade those nuclear weapons for a diplomatic solution with the United States. And the one thing I would say about a sort of relentless drive towards nuclear weapons is, if they really wanted nuclear weapons, they would have done it 10 years ago.
On this question of whether or not North Korea has genuine security concerns, now, what the government has said in response to the kind of comments that President Bush has made, they make it sound as if, that is, the government of North Korea makes it sound as if they feel genuinely threatened by the United States. Now, we could say from our point of view that we're not going to start a war with North Korea, but that's just saying that is probably not going to make them feel any better about the threat that we constitute, if indeed they think that we do. And then that sets aside the issue of any potential threat coming from any place else. Is there indeed a genuine security threat to the North?
Sure. I mean, what we have is, we have an armistice. The Korean War has never been formally ended. We have no peace treaty with North Korea, so we are still formally at war with North Korea. Remember all the stuff that had to happen last summer when Bush wanted to get approval from Congress to start a war in Iraq? He doesn't have to do that with North Korea because we're still at war right now. So we can attack, quote-unquote, at any time. We have them targeted in the 2002 nuclear posture review. We have 36,000 troops on the ground. This is a situation in which there is not a whole lot of friendship between the two countries.
This is Victor.
You see it differently?
Yeah, I see it differently. And again, this is why we wrote the book. I mean, in the sense that for your listeners out there, readers of the book get an opportunity to hear two opposing arguments on North Korean intentions and how to deal with North Korea. And the problem with a lot of the stuff out there on North Korea, the little that there is, tends to be very one-sided. Either, you know, a super hawkish attitude or a super dovish attitude. And what we try to do in the book is say, here are the two best arguments from a more skeptical and more optimistic perspective. You decide for yourself which makes more sense. I tend to disagree with Dave on this notion of the United States posing an imminent threat to the North. The North Koreans certainly have seen the United States on the peninsula for 50 years, but the U.S. position on the peninsula has been entirely defensive. The United States has no intention to invade or attack North Korea without provocation. The basis of the U.S. alliance relationship with North Korea, formed in 1953 and 54, was one in which the United States would come to the aid of South Korea if it ever were attacked by the North. On the few occasions that you had South Korean leaders that wanted to do something to the North without provocation, the United States explicitly said, absolutely not. That we harbor no aggressive intentions in that sense.
Some people, I think, would argue that this whole relationship has been complicated by the fact that, that we were at this point once before in the Clinton administration,
right,
and that the Clinton administration had the same concerns that the Bush administration does about the possibility that North Korea would develop nuclear weapons, and entered into an agreement with the North to try to help them with the things that they needed most, and made agreements to help them with supplying energy in the short term to supply them with oil, and then in the long term to build some nuclear power plants that could be, that were specifically for generating energy for that, as opposed to making material that you could make bombs out of. And then in exchange, what the North Koreans were supposed to agree to is that they were then going to stop their nuclear program. Now, there are, again, two sides to this, but again, looking at the side of the United States and the West, I think some people would argue that we failed and to fulfill the commitment we made to North Korea, and that only made things more difficult between the two sides.
Well, this is Victor. I mean, the notion that the United States failed to live up to the agreed framework, I think, is and I know my co-author Dave is going to disagree with me here
very vigorously.
is, I think, a grossly inaccurate portrayal of the events. There was an agreement in which the United States would provide interim sources of heavy fuel oil and, in conjunction with Japan and South Korea, build more proliferation-resistant light water reactors in North Korea. They did fall behind in the schedule of implementing that, but in the end, the United States, up until the current nuclear crisis, fulfilled every commitment down to the dollar that it made in terms of giving those oil shipments to North Korea and moving forward with the light water reactor project. So they fell behind schedule. There's no denying that. But they fulfilled what they were going to do. At the same time, on the North Korean side, they did things that were in violation of the agreement. They were not complete innocents in this either. Mm-hmm. They were taking steps that were clearly in violation of the agreement, the most egregious of which was the idea of starting a second covert nuclear weapons program, which clearly violated the spirit of the 1994 agreement, an agreement, I have to admit, which was a very good agreement, one negotiated by my current boss at Georgetown, my dean at Georgetown, Bob Gallucci.
Well, let me turn to David Kang and have you respond to both, but specifically that last point, because some people indeed will argue, well, that maybe we have not been as diligent in fulfilling the agreements as we said we would, but at the same time, what we found out, and this was when things have gotten particularly tense over the last year or so, we found out that, in fact, the government of North Korea had a secret program to develop weapons, and that they were, in fact, doing what they promised they would not do.
First of all, it wasn't secret. The North Koreans said in the summer of 1998, you guys are not fulfilling your side of the bargain, and if you continue to not fulfill the side of your bargain, we may start up another program. So it really was no surprise. And this is absolutely where Victor and I disagree, because it is one thing to say, okay, we basically want to do this, but we're just having some troubles. And it's another to have a genuine grudging problems with fulfilling our side, which is what happened. The agreed framework was designed to create trust between two countries that really don't trust each other. Neither side began, from the beginning, neither side was really fulfilling their side. So as a result, it's no surprise that that the agreement framework fell apart. And let me give you an example. 2 weeks after we signed the agreed framework, U.S. nuclear scientists and government officials went to Yongbyon, the nuclear facility, to figure out how to start canning the spent fuel rods. It was part of the agreement that they were going to store those and make it clear they couldn't make bombs out of them. At that time, the U.S. officials said, okay, we'll be back in 6 weeks to start doing X, Y, and Z. They got back to America. Remember, this is 2 weeks after the agreed framework is signed. And the government had not funded it. Congress had actually not funded the agreed framework. So they couldn't go back. They couldn't do anything. It was 6 months before they could even call the North Koreans and say, okay, we may be back at this time. So from the very beginning, we didn't hold up our side of the bargain. And it's true that, yeah, maybe at some point we might have been able to, but we said that we would provide written assurances against nuclear first use, and we haven't. They're still targeted. We said that we would provide the light water reactors. They're 4 to 5 years behind schedule, not because of technical difficulties, but because we don't want to fund it. And so the North Koreans, I don't see any reason why they would trust us to actually fulfill our side. I don't see why we would trust them either. And so the agreed framework fell apart.
I want to ask a question particularly to Victor Cha and ask whether you think that it was a mistake for President Bush and the Bush administration to take such an aggressive rhetorical stand on North Korea.
By that, you're referring to the Axis of Evil statement?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think we have to take that in the context of, you know, the situation we were facing. I mean, that statement came only a few months after September 11th. It came at a time prior to which the United States had done, under the Bush administration, an initial policy review of what should be done with North Korea. In June of 2001, reached the conclusion to that policy review where the United States said they'd be willing to engage with North Korea on any issue, any place, any time, and sought a more comprehensive agreement or deal with North Korea. The North Koreans responded to that by saying, this notion of any place, any time, anywhere, anything on the agenda is a unilateral demand by the United States, and we will not meet because the United States is making unilateral demands. So the question of who really was not interested in meeting in the first place, I think, is really called into question there. I think the popular view is to sort of blame it on the United States, but I don't think that's accurate. The other thing is, there's no denying that the axis of evil statement certainly heated things up between the United States and North Korea, but I would make two points there. One, that the regime is evil. I mean, it allows people to die, and I'm sure it's something we'll talk about within the hour, but this is a regime that has allowed nearly 2.2 million of its own citizens to die of starvation, while it devotes 33% of its national resources to building nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. Secondly, the axis of evil statement may have heated things up, but if you process trace what was happening both in North-South relations and in U.S.-North Korean relations prior to the Bush administration ever coming into office, in other words, the latter half of 2000, things were already going bad between the North and the South and between the United States and North Korea. So the notion that it's all this administration's fault, I think, is a highly inaccurate statement.
Professor Kang, you want to respond to the same question?
Yeah, I mean, the roots of the problem have much more to do with long-term U.S. attitudes towards North Korea than any individual administration. The Clinton administration didn't want to engage at first either. And as I said before, they were grudging in how much they actually held by the agreed framework. So there's no doubt that both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, have not carried the ball. On the other hand, I would say that Bush happened to make it a little more intense, but...
All right. Well, we have two guests with us this morning. Let me introduce them again for anybody who has just tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Victor Cha teaches at Georgetown University. David Kang is at Dartmouth. And together, they have authored a book titled Nuclear North Korea, A Debate on Engagement Strategies. And as you have heard, they take two different positions on the issue of North Korea and how we should be dealing with that country. Their book is published by the Columbia University Press. It's out in bookstores now. And we are welcoming people who are listening. If you'd like to ask questions, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we'll start Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I've heard that it was actually the election that Gingrich Revolution that supposedly, I don't want to be an apologist for the Clinton administration because I think it's true what was just said, that there's a continuity of policy here, but that the agreed framework was undercut by the loss of the House. The funding was not possible. They couldn't get it through. And I don't know if that's true or not, and that's what I didn't particularly want to call about that. But I always turn to what's going on in South Korea, it seems to me, and we've heard comment about the pulling back of the troops from the DMZ, and one would think that that was a Pacific sort of thing to do, but given the fact that the U.S. is considering decapitation attacks, actually pulling troops back from the border is supposedly seen as making way for that kind of attack. Obviously, you can't pull Seoul back from the border, but... Anyway, but I've heard of something else, and I've been researching it and trying to find about it, which is that maybe in the process of reorganizing the troop deployments, pulling out of the middle of Seoul and all that, that actually the U.S. has moved short-range missiles closer to the border. So this is you don't have to be a paranoid state to regard that as provocative. So, and I don't see any comment on it anywhere. I can't find it on any of the military websites. I heard it on the Voice of America, just as a throwaway line that the U.S. had actually moved missiles closer to the DMZ, as well as moving troops back. I just think that that isn't very conducive to any kind of negotiation, it seems to me, multilateral, bilateral, or whatever. I don't know if you have any response directly to that.
Let's do that. We'll go in alphabetical order. Professor Chow, you can go first.
Yeah, I mean, the caller's got good questions. He's obviously someone who looks at the issue fairly carefully. First point I would make is he's absolutely right. The agreed framework was negotiated and signed in October of 1994, and following that, congressional elections gave the majority to the Republicans, who made it very difficult to implement the agreed framework for the Clinton administration. Now, having said that, the question then becomes, you blame the United States for that in terms of violating the agreed framework or not? And I would argue that you don't, because the North Koreans went into the agreed framework, you know, they're not stupid. They went into the agreed framework knowing that they were dealing with a democracy and knowing that, you know, the implementation of the agreed framework would be subject to the vagaries of domestic politics and congressional elections. It's not as simple as it is in North Korea, where the North Korean leadership just negotiates an agreement. They say, that's that. This is the way it's going to be. And in fact, there was a private minute between the United States and North Korea that in many ways acknowledged these possible vagaries. The second point on the pullback of forces, the pulling back of forces, I think is interpreted by some incorrectly as the United States preparing for preemptive attack against North Korea. The fact that they may move missiles closer to the North, I can't verify that. I don't know that. Is to me not a symbol that they're trying to attack North Korea, but as they rebalance and realign their forces on the Korean Peninsula and in East Asia, part of maintaining the deterrent is to be able to maintain your military capabilities as you move back your forces. And I think that's the spirit in which these sorts of things, if they are indeed happening, would be made. The second thing we have to remember is that it's not easy for the United States to contemplate attack against North Korea. I mean, the North Koreans, if the United States were ever to do that, are able to fire thousands and thousands of rounds of artillery on the capital city of Seoul, killing hundreds of thousands, potentially, of not just Koreans, but American expats. You know, there's a 100,000 American expat community in South Korea, not to mention what they could also do to Japan with ballistic missiles. Now, the North Koreans can do all this without nuclear weapons. They can do this with a conventional deterrent. So why they need nuclear weapons for security purposes is not clear.
Professor Kang, you want to, again, respond to the same sort of...
yes. Absolutely. And that's the thing I was talking about is, we signed the agreed framework and then there's no money for it, so all the things we said we would do, we didn't. Even things... The framework was more than that, though, because there were things that weren't necessarily funded, which were written assurances against targeting them with nukes, for example, which we also have not done, lifting of sanctions, which we still have some in place. So the agreed framework has, served in some ways a very good purpose, because they could have a lot more nukes right now if we had not come to that agreement. I'd make one point, which is when we think about North Korean actions or intentions, we really have to keep in mind an interactive effect between what we do and how they respond, and then what they do and how we respond. And you can go back and back and back to, you did this, then I did that, then you did this. And we're both locked in this very, very mistrustful, dangerous situation. Regarding the troops pulling them back, I think on the whole, this is probably a good step. If we didn't have the crisis going on right now, there's a lot of just good reasons why we would pull the troops out of this downtown military base. When the base in Yongsan in Seoul was originally built in the 50s, the city was nowhere near it. It was built outside of Seoul. And, of course, the city has grown up all around it. It leads to any number of just problems that inevitable, just that it's incredibly valuable real estate. You've got a bunch of troops right there with a bunch of civilians. So it makes sense to pull them out. The timing, of course, is not auspicious. Because it does lead everyone in South Korea and North Korea to think this is getting ready for a preemptive strike. But as Victor said, nobody wants to start a war on the peninsula. we've had 50 years of successful deterrence. We have no reason to think that it would break down now.
Well, we're conflating two issues here, it seems to me, if I'm on. Pulling, you know, repositioning troops out of the center of a, you know, vibrant city is one thing, but pulling them back from the DMZ, you know, knowing that the hermit, you know, that North Korea is going to interpret it, you know, at least several ways. You know, I don't think it is just the troops in Seoul that were pulled back. It was troops also along, you know, further forward deployed along the line. So, I mean, it seems to me that it does. I think it was calculated to do that actually too, and it's just frustrating to me that I can't find documentation about troop movements and these missile deployments that I'm absolutely positive I heard about it, and there's just no comment on it. At least ought to be analyzed. So, thanks a lot. I'll let someone else have a chance.
We are, again, at our midpoint here. We'd certainly welcome other callers if you'd like to talk with our guests, Victor Cha and David Kang, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to go back here for a moment to something that Professor Cha said a while ago, talking about the kind of threat that the North poses to the South, and the fact that, nuclear weapons aside, they have a lot of conventional weapons and could inflict a great deal of damage. The question, though, in my mind would be, we're saying that they have that ability, but my question would be, why would they? Why would they do that? Why would they launch war against the South?
Should I start?
Yes, I was sort of intending that for Victor first, and then
wait,
to Dave King.
Okay. Why would they?
Why would they attack? What reason would the North have for launching an attack against South Korea?
Well, I mean, the first point is that the key thing here is we're trying to figure out what North Korean intentions are, right? And we know that they hold this tremendous conventional deterrent. I mean, the United States is the most powerful military in the history of the world. North Korea is this puny little country, yet we say the United States really can't contemplate preemptive attack because the North Koreans have what's known as the tyranny of proximity. They hold the city of Seoul hostage. They can do this with conventional weapons. If the United States were ever to consider attacking, they could hold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people hostage in Seoul, and that would, you know, to the extent that the United States still values those lives, that would deter the United States. But my point is, if they have that conventional deterrent, if they have a very secure deterrent, and that has worked for them for 50 years, right, then why is it all of a sudden now that they say they need nuclear weapons for security? My main point is, I don't think they need nuclear weapons for security because they have this conventional deterrent. Their desire for nuclear weapons actually goes back to Kim Il-sung, the first leader of North Korea, goes back to the 1950s and 60s, and is part of a long-term national project for North Korea to become a nuclear weapon state. They see that they're a country that cares very much about face and status. They believe in being a rich nation, strong army. They're not the rich nation part, but they're certainly the strong army part. And in many ways, achieving that nuclear weapons capability is a long-term goal for the regime and the state.
Well, given, though, that what we've said, we've talked about the fact that even though the war never officially ended, we have gone 50 years now without further conflict, we also would say we'd think that nuclear proliferation is not a good thing, but does it really make things any more dangerous if the government of North Korea had a handful of nuclear weapons, given the fact that they also have this large conventional force? And does that indeed bring us any closer to the brink of war than we were 2 years
ago?
Right.
Well, you know, it's a good question. And in terms of the balance of forces on the peninsula and conventional deterrence, the addition of nuclear weapons in North Korea probably does not significantly alter the prospects for war on the peninsula. But again, we have to think about the outcome here. We're talking about the most opaque state in the world with a bankrupt economy that now is producing nuclear weapons and fissile material. And as the New York Times reported just this week or last week, the North Koreans, you know, are willing to sell this stuff if they have it. They defaulted on a deal, in fact, in which they were supposed to supply Iraq with a whole line, an assembly line of short-range ballistic missiles, which they had developed in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. So this is a country that does not have much. The only thing it has that it can sell on the open market are these missiles and these nuclear materials. And the thought, particularly in a post-September 11th environment, of a country like North Korea having this stuff and peddling it, I don't think is something that's very comforting.
Yeah, that's here. Well, let me turn again to Professor Kang. That's something we really hadn't quite touched on yet. That is, it's one thing to think about what North Korea might do with whatever weaponry it could produce. It's yet another to think about who it is they might provide weaponry to.
Yeah, let me go back first, though, to the deterrence.
Sure, yeah.
No question that deterrence has held for 50 years, and that's why neither North Korea nor the United States, despite all the blustery rhetoric, really goes too far down that path of starting a war. North Korea might if we actually have a preemptive strike, and that's why we don't think about a preemptive strike on the Yongbyon nuclear facility, because then you are rolling the dice. In terms of the conventional capabilities, and then why would they need nuclear weapons, there are two things when you think about it. The first one is, we didn't do that. The United States, when we were deterring the Soviet Union, didn't say, well, we've got 40 nuclear weapons, that's enough. What we said was, if 40 is good, maybe 400 is better, and maybe 10,000 is better, way beyond what we thought was necessary to deter. So this is, you know, not surprising that countries want to try and defend themselves, especially when conventionally it's true that they have artillery tubes, but we also know how badly trained and how outgunned their conventional forces are. The United States is the most powerful military in the history of the world. It's not at all surprising that they view nuclear weapons as an addition to their deterrent on their side as the balance begins to tip towards the United States. So if they really wanted them, they would have built them and deployed them under Kim Il-sung. And they haven't, because I think what they want is a resolution to the, you know, million men that are staring at each other on the DMZ. As to the export, absolutely that is a concern. North Korea has sold its missiles, it has sold other technologies, and that's something where, again, since it's a concern, we need to deal with the problem. And I think that a coercive strategy that just increases pressure is highly unlikely to get North Korea to actually back down from its nuclear program. Since it's a concern, we have to take it seriously.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the problem and perhaps not so much about potential solutions. And obviously, all parties concerned with this seem, in Asia, the Chinese, the Japanese, the South Koreans, in addition, the United States, just about everyone would like to see a diplomatic resolution to this. I don't think anybody doesn't seem to be anybody who's really interested in there being a war and would like to prevent that. There are, however, again, different ideas about how it is we go about that. I'll stay with David Kang, and then we'll go back to Victor Chan and ask each of you to talk a little bit about what you think would be the appropriate path to take to try to resolve this.
Well, the basic thing, we can either choose a coercive strategy or we can choose a more engaging strategy. Toward that end, pressure is only met with pressure by the North Koreans. That's pretty obvious. An engagement strategy that genuinely attempts to provide for some of their concerns, security in particular, is probably the best way to go, which would mean more than the occasional rhetorical statement by President Bush. This is the thing where, when Victor was talking about the democracy and how things can change in the United States, that's precisely why the North Koreans are really mistrustful of the United States, because somebody saying something is very different than a genuine policy that is, you know, sort of moving the whole ship in a new direction that says, okay, we're going to try and find a way to alleviate your concerns. Over the long run, I think here's something I would like the listeners to think about. We're totally focused on this current crisis, and we were totally focused 10 years ago, and then we kicked the can down the road 5, 10 years, and we have another crisis. We need to think about the fact that North Korea may survive for another 2 or 3 decades. No sign now that it's going to collapse right away. And so what is long-term U.S. policy going to be, even if we resolve this crisis? And toward that end, I think promoting capitalism and encouraging them to open up is the way to go.
Well,
I'll respond. I agree with David that, you know, no one wants a military solution, in large part because a military solution would require that you'd expect through a military strike that you could actually take out and end North Korea's nuclear program. And I don't think there's enough intelligence there that tells us we know where everything is, so it wouldn't even be successful. And so what you're left with, I mean, I think what you're left with is continuing some form of dialogue with the North, but you have to have pressure. I mean, you have to have some sort of pressure on this regime because it's, I mean, Dave and I disagree. Historically, I think this is what they respond to in a positive way, particularly if they understand that every country in the region is on the same side. In 1994, in June of 1994, as some of your listeners know, we almost went to war with North Korea. What happened at that particular time was that former President Jimmy Carter went to North Korea and was able to broker a deal. The general popular perception of that particular moment in history was that it was Carter's engagement that led to the deal. I don't think that's true. I mean, what led to the deal was the fact that President Carter was in North Korea at a time when the North Koreans knew that the United States was beginning to send reinforcements and mobilize for a possible conflict on the peninsula. And if they had not known that, they wouldn't have been so flexible in terms of seeking out a deal. So I don't think Dave and I agree that much on the engagement part. What we really disagree on is how much pressure should be applied as you pursue dialogue with the regime.
We have time for certainly other questions and comments. We're moving into about our last 10-15 minutes. If people would like to call in, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest, Victor Cha. He's a professor of government at Georgetown University, and David King, he's professor at Dartmouth. And the two of them together have written a book. They lay out their ideas in the book. It's titled Nuclear North Korea, A Debate on Engagement Strategies, and it is published by the Columbia University Press. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the government of South Korea thinks about all of this and what people in the South think about the long-term potential for the relationship between North and South and whether people are thinking seriously or talking seriously about the possibility of Korea becoming one country again in this lifetime.
I'll let Dave go first, since he's just written something on this.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, those are you know, really good questions. I mean, one of the things, just in terms of when we look at unification, is my family's actually originally from North Korea, left in 1947. And my great-grandfather, when he left, said, in my lifetime and in my son's lifetime, we'll never be unified. Now, obviously, we're on to four generations that have not seen unification, and we could easily be another one or two more. And so we really do need to start thinking about what might happen over the long run. In terms of actually South Korea, right now there's not a whole lot of desire for unification because people are worried that the cost would be very high. And absorbing and bringing the North Korean economy back up to sort of decent world standards would be a huge drain on the South Korean economy. That being said, I don't think anyone in South Korea is desirous, would oppose unification right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with David here. I mean, I think generally if you talk to South Koreans and you ask them do they want unification, of course they say, of course we want unification. It's part of how they define themselves. But at the same time, what they say and what they really want are two different things. I mean, I think ideally they want unification, but practically speaking, you know, they learned a lot from the German example and the difficulties encountered by the two Germanys unifying. They also understood that the costs for South Korea, both socially and economically, are going to be much higher in a Korean case than the German case because the income gaps are wider across every sort of macro indicator. It shows that the South Korean job of absorbing the North would be infinitely more difficult than West Germany had with the East. And then finally, you know, there's a saying in Korea it's 이만불 시대, which means the 20,000 era. And South Koreans, you know, they're an OECD country right now. They came from virtually nothing in the 1950s. Becoming an OECD country, the 11th largest economy in the world. They don't want the North Koreans to upset that party. They don't want the absorption costs of trying to unify with North Korea to prevent them from getting to that goal of 20,000, the 20,000 era, or 20,000 per capita income era. So it's a very pragmatic attitude towards unification.
Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Chicago on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Some 20 or more years ago, our military came to the conclusion finally that basing our strategy on atomic weapons would be suicidal because of the release of radioactivity whenever a bomb is dropped and that sort of thing. And the Russians also came around to that same point of view, and this eventually was permitted us to start loosening up our policies, that is, reducing our weapons finally. Has anything changed along those lines?
Well, one, both of you, I guess, can comment if you feel that you can. Professor Cha, maybe you want to go first?
I think the, clearly during the Cold War, what deterred the United States and the Soviet Union was a common understanding and an internalization of the norms of stable deterrence. You know, basically this notion of mutually assured destruction, and part of that and other things were enabled them to enter into certain arms limitation talks. How that applies to the Korean Peninsula, it's difficult to say. I mean, the deterrence part certainly applies to the Korean Peninsula, but the notion that North Korea is trying to seek a counter-deterrent to the United States' nuclear capability, it seems to me, is not what we're talking about here. I think what we're talking about is a country that wants to, it may be interested eventually in giving away some of its nuclear weapons or trading away parts of its program to get another agreed framework, to get another agreement like 1994 where they can try to get security, fuel, and other things. But in the end, I don't think they're going to give up their nuclear weapons. Rarely do countries who make the decision, the national decision to cross the nuclear threshold, rarely do they make that decision and then simply bargain it away once they've made that choice. You've had a few cases, a few exceptions of nuclear rollback in that sense, but those exceptions more prove the rule.
But does anyone in our government understand that radioactivity is a suicidal strategy to upon which to base our policy?
Well,
does the president, so-called, he acts as if an atom bomb is just another weapon, and he blusters and all this sort of thing, and he's not any better than the Koreans, North Koreans.
To an extent, it's important to keep differences in rhetoric versus actions in mind.
And well, you can't keep the rhetoric out of it because this is a fact, and
Yeah. Well, I don't. I think that was David Kang. Was
yeah.
You want to continue?
Yeah, we haven't actually used nuclear weapons since 1945, precisely because I think nobody really wants to go down that path unless it's a last case scenario. So there's a lot of discussion about it. But again, just to be clear about the rhetoric. George Bush has not been threatening to nuke North Korea. Even the Nuclear Posture Review, it does reserve the right, but we don't say that we're planning on nuking North Korea.
One thing, we're sort of short on details on what's going on in North Korea, but we do know from the small number of journalists that do get to visit that life in North Korea is very hard. And I'm thinking about not very long ago there was an article in the New Yorker magazine, I think it was by Philip Gurevich, and it was accompanied by a photograph, and this was a photograph taken from space, which showed and it was taken at nighttime from space, and in the south you can see it's a blaze of light, and in the north it's dark. There's not a light on. So we know that the life in the north is very hard, and we also know that people in the north don't know a great deal about what's going on in the outside world. If such a thing was possible, what do you think would happen if indeed it was possible for people in the north to get a better idea about what was going on outside of their country?
This is Victor. I mean, I think we've already seen some evidence of that, and that is we're seeing more and more people trying to defect from North Korea. They can't really do anything to change the system within North Korea, so they're basically voting with their feet by trying to leave the country. Despite great threat to their life, and if they're caught, and to people they leave behind as they go. If more and more people in North Korea are aware of the situation in their country vis-a-vis the rest of the world, I'm sure you'd see a lot more people trying to defect. And the North Korean government, because of the rash of defections that have been increasing since about 2 years ago, starting about 2 years ago, has been clamping down. I mean, particularly on people trying to escape through the land border to China, has been cracking down, doing sweeps to try to bring back all of these illegal migrants into China.
Yeah, let me jump in as well. A couple things. The first one is the more that the North Korean citizens know about the outside world and their own country, the better it will be for everyone and the more likely that we will find them actually trying to get some kind of change in North Korea, which is one reason I think we should encourage trade and exchange of people. The second thing, and your listeners should be aware of this, there has been change in North Korea. It hasn't been nearly as dramatic as some people would like, but North Korea is far more open now than it was 10 years ago. There's been over 100,000 South Koreans who have gone to visit North Korea. You can drive through the DMZ now on a repaved highway that goes through, as well as a railroad. And most importantly, in July of 2002, North Korea abandoned the centrally planned economy. So prices are now set by supply and demand. There are private markets in existence, and they suspect there are about $1 billion U.S. dollars in circulation in North Korea that are used to buy foreign goods and things. So there is real change that's going on, and that can only bode well. And I think that, again, that we should encourage this kind of economic openness.
Hmm. We're just about out of time. Let me turn to Victor Cha. Is just sort of a last thought you'd like to leave with folks who are listening?
I don't disagree with Dave's point about the North doing some things in terms of economic reform. The only thing that I would add to that is, you can be a country like North Korea, a dictatorial regime, that's seeking economic reform because you're trying to get the economy going again, you're trying to make some money, basically. But at the same time, you can do that and still want to have nuclear weapons. I think there's a tendency to conflate these two and to assume that just because they're trying to make steps to reform economically, this means that there's an automatic link to their giving up nuclear weapons because they want economic reform. They could want both. They could want nuclear weapons and economic reform, because they probably feel that that's the formula for success in today's world.
Professor Kang, last thought?
This is a reprehensible, brutal, repressive dictatorship up in North Korea, and nobody wants to see them survive very long. I think Victor and I also both agree that what we both want is an end to the regime and economic change up there and no nuclear weapons on the peninsula. The real place where we disagree is on tactics as to how best to achieve it, but both of us agree on the ultimate goal. The other thing I'd point out is that our quarrel is not with the citizens. They're the victims of the regime as much as anyone else. And so hopefully we can find a policy that will be successful.
Well, I want to thank you both very much, Victor Cha from Georgetown. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
And David Kang from Dartmouth, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And if you're interested in reading on this subject, again, I'll mention the book that our guests have co-authored. It's titled Nuclear North Korea, A Debate on Engagement Strategies by our guests Victor Cha, David Kang. The book is published by the Columbia University Press.